This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Tonight in the programme we're talking about terrorism, the city and the state. And joining me in the studio are Liam Kennedy, Mike Davis, Anne Larrabee and Harvey O'Brien. You're all very welcome to The 11th Hour. Liam, you organised the gathering took place in UCD yesterday. The scope of the conference, terrorism, the city, the state. How did it go for you?
It went very well. We had a good gathering of academics and other people, architects, for example, who came from other parts of the world to talk about some of the relationships between urbanism, urban design, urban living, and violence in urban centres, and what the relationship between those two things are. And we also had a good attendance from the public who came to listen to that and to talk about it. So a very good day.
The architects getting involved, that's a new sort of wing to this discussion, is it?
It's not that new, but it's happening more often because the architects are obviously getting drawn into the discussion about what should cities do to defend themselves against urban violence. And so the architects are advising on how to build and how to design with an eye on that. And one of the architects we had in yesterday is somebody who's very active in designing buildings and commenting on building design in the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. Now, in the middle of that conflict, building design is very much tied up with urban design and military advance. These things are all linked together because you want to make space safe or you want to take over this space for your own means. But that's becoming an issue in other parts of the world as well. But that's a hot spot in this debate.
Mike, in your writing about Los Angeles, you said that the architecture and the planning of the city has been a disaster from day one.
Well, but I specifically focused on the way that fear, and often exaggerated fears that bear no real relationship to the actual threat or crime rate or risk, increasingly dominate the design of the city and diminish public space in the city. But, you know, it's interesting talking about yesterday's conference and the role of architectures and counterinsurgency and dealing with terrorism, because probably one of the precedents for this is city planning in Belfast. And as I'm sure a lot of listeners know, that when Divis Flats was torn down in Belfast and when new housing, row housing, was built, many of it, much of it excellent housing, apparently the Army had some role, or the RUC some role in the design. Out went the neighborhoods where you could run through the house out the back door
and then hop over the wall and be gone.
And in came cul-de-sacs and walls. I mean, there was careful thought was applied to make neighborhoods as amenable to policing and to security as possible. Israel's usually promoted as the template for security and counterterrorism, but, you know, in many ways, Belfast is equally important.
And Larrabee, this urban terror or urban problems are not a new thing. We think they're recent things, but historically this has been with us for a long time.
That's correct. It really, what I look at in my work is the emergence of modern terror in the United States after the American Civil War. And I'm especially looking at the emergence of radical groups in the United States who turn to high explosives and bomb making as a way to carry out their political ends. And the ideas that they had about the craft of bomb making really came from the Civil War and also from a burgeoning science education and the circulation of texts having to do with science. And they took those ideas and they put them together. And so they carried out several attacks that have many resonances today, I think.
Those attacks were what, by labor movements or by anarchists? Or what were the cause for those attacks?
Yes, well, certainly the Fenians were very active, and they plotted against London, and so they planted bombs in London train stations at that time. And then there were also anarchists working, but some groups that not many people know about are the Cuban cigar workers in Florida and also the Sikhs in California, and they all communicated with each other, and they shared ideas about explosives and bomb making.
This was a sort of a historical al-Qaeda of its own, network of its own.
Well, it's interesting in that way because European governments thought of the United States as harboring terrorists at that time, so.
Mike, your new book to be published is Buddha's Wagon, A Brief History of the Car Bomb, but I must go to Harvey on this one because we had a big controversy over this some years back with Michael Collins. this movie by Neil Jordan, and he depicted a car bomb. What was the controversy about
that? That's right. I was just telling Mike about this outside, that in fact, in one scene in the film, a group of Northern Protestants come down to help the British government in Dublin Castle, who haven't been efficient enough in tracking down the terrorists. And I think it was Ian McElhenney was, in fact, the leader of the party. And in a scene immediately after they arrive, they walk out of their building, and McElhenney says, well, what you boyos need down here is a little bit of Northern efficiency. And they step into their car, which explodes. And of course, historically, there were no car bombs during the War of Independence. And then Neil Jordan kind of made the rather unfortunate remark in the press that it was intended as a joke, and people didn't find it especially funny. So it really fueled the fire of that particular controversy around Michael Collins.
But there were car bombs. This was 1919 that Michael Collins from you identified the first car bomb as 1920 in your book.
Well, the prototype was an anarchist horse-drawn wagon full of scrap metal and dynamite, the Italian anarchist Mario Buda, which is why my book's called Buda's Wagon, blew up Wall Street and killed 40 people in September 1920. And almost immediately, the Catalan anarchists, the Anarchist Union, the CNT, unsuccessfully tried to use a car bomb, rolled a car full of dynamite down on the police in Barcelona. But the car bomb really appears as a serious weapon of urban guerrilla warfare only in Palestine in 1947-48, first used by right-wing Zionist groups, the Stern Gang and the Irgun, against the British, and then they used them against the Palestinians, and the Palestinians returned the favor with the aid of a group of British deserters, and their really horrible carnage in Jerusalem and Jaffa in the end of 1947-1948. Then it reappears in Saigon in 52, Algiers in 61. So it's really a myth. It's a very common myth, though. It's repeated in a lot of literature on terrorism, that the car bomb is an Irish weapon invented by the Provisional IRA in, you know, 71 or 72, and that's simply not true. It was already well entrenched as a tactic of urban guerrilla warfare.
But you consider this to be an extremely destabilizing weapon in that it just, it's incorporated, cars are in our society. How can we identify a bomb?
Well, there was an important polemic, actually, in the African National Congress, which was under enormous pressure from grassroots Africans to retaliate for some of the atrocities of the apartheid regime, both in South Africa and in bombing of frontline states. And Nelson Mandela wrote an incredibly eloquent letter from prison explaining his opposition to this. This is a seductive weapon. It's cheap and easy to make. It's extremely powerful, but it almost always ensures the death of innocents, and it puts at stake the moral stature, the nobility of the cause. And this, unfortunately, is the lesson that the Provisional IRA or the Basque nationalists have discovered. Seduced by the car bomb's power, say Sean Mustafin was, and the early 1970s, but the moral damage ultimately to the cause and the alienation of people, because, you know, civilians die. It's a promiscuous weapon, and as I claim in my book, actually a fascist weapon.
And Larrabee, the morals of the car bomb, how can a terrorist organization have moral stances or moralistic stances?
Well, I really think that they don't have moral stances, and that when I look at these groups, what I see is people who become much more fascinated with the technology than they do even about their moral or political cause. And they become quite secretive, and they begin to look, they become inward turned rather than outward turned towards actual change. And they can't really take a moral stance. They no longer, to my mind, have a right to power.
Liam, is that the case? Do people get caught up in the actual technology or the energy of terrorism that they can't see any way out of it? That's why it took us so long up the north to come out of it.
I think that can happen, but there's another ingredient I think needs to be borne in mind, and that's the media coverage of this. I mean, terrorism, the media are tied into a relationship that, you know, clearly the media don't want to be part of, but, you know, if a bomb goes off, the media is going to cover that. The terrorists know this. And that, in part, is part of the bombing process. I mean, to put it all too simply, if a bomb goes off and the media doesn't cover it, at one level, it didn't happen. Because the whole point of the terrorist act is to create the reaction as much as to create the act itself. So the media spectacle becomes part of this whole process, and that becomes very potent and very powerful. And that's what feeds the paranoia and the fear of living in cities once terrorism takes hold.
But the media are colluding in this, Mike, to make more money, to sell their papers.
Yeah, but of course, you know, the novel phenomena that we now see across the world, but most of all in Iraq, is that in the past, these propagandists of the deed were dependent on the media, and if the media wanted, it could turn off the event. But now, the people who are doing the car bombs, particularly those aimed against Shiite civilians in Iraq, have their own media. Yeah, they not only manufacture the atrocity, but they, put it on the internet. They spin the meaning of it. They're literally, auteurs. They're acting with cinematic authority to project their carnage to the world. And this, of course, what the car bomb is most suited for people whose actual purpose is to kill innocents, to create terror and panic. And it's particularly suited for that reason, to clandestine state intelligence organizations or to marginal individuals or causes trying to make a lot of noise through terror. But the technology of the car bomb is no longer just the dynamite or the fertilizer in the back of the truck. It's also the internet, the video image, the whole control over the production of the event itself.
Harvey, but terrorism has always been depicted in movies.
Yeah, I mean, and since the beginning, every kind. I mean, I suppose.
And, of course, today's terrorist could be tomorrow's Nelson Mandela, statesman.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other debate. But, yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, the thing is that film, of course, has become the inheritor of story in terms of how we explain our worlds to ourselves. And while the media is certainly available as a delivery system and as a reactive form of making sense of things, it's there, it's right in front of you, and it can be used in that way. Film tends to come along a little bit later and try to assemble those elements into something resembling a narrative, a story that makes sense of it for a particular purpose. Then that, of course, is subject to the forces that create that story. So it serves yet another political purpose in terms of how the story is told, what perspective it gives on those events, and how that story is then filtered through to the audiences who are there expecting a certain kind of entertainment or a certain kind of story. And this is, of course, where the big question comes about the representation of terrorism, especially post 9/11. This question of entertainment and what is it you're looking for when you see these films. So United 93, of course, immediately walks straight into that particular, minefield and came out of it fairly well from a critical perspective, actually. People tended to say, actually, it got the tone very right.
That was an interesting movie. It was a technique. It was what they call mockumentary. It meshed the drama with the reality. Did it work as a movie, first of all?
Well, I think it did. I think Paul Greengrass established his credentials by making Bloody Sunday, which again electrified people in the use of some techniques of documentary in filming the story dramatically. That again is nothing unusual. That has been around since the beginnings of the cinema. Docudrama has been there as long as documentary has. So Greengrass used the same kind of technique, which is, I mean, it's just a stylistic mystification to use a shaky camera to suggest documentary. But more important than that, what the film was striving towards was some sense of the actual, some sense of the moment, some sense that you're actually in a place at a particular time. And with United 93, that was actually crucial to making the film work, because although there are establishing scenes set in the airport, and they're extremely important because they show the Arab terrorists, in themselves kind of, fearing what it is they're about to go into, the film takes place entirely inside the plane for the most part. It does cut away to the control centres, but what you don't get is what you're expecting, which is that spectacle of disaster. You don't see the city of New York in a series of establishing shots. You don't see the big explosions. That's not there. It's just not present. And what you're forced to do, in a sense, is to relive this very tight time period in a confined space. Well, two confined spaces, the control room and inside the plane. And to me, it worked very well. I was surprised because I wasn't necessarily expecting it to work well. And when 9/11 happened, I mean, among the many thoughts going through my head was, that will be the story that will be filmed, United 93. When I heard one plane went down, and sure enough, it was the story that was told.
How long must we wait after an event like 9/11 before we can make art about it? Do we start right away?
I actually visited Ground Zero a few months after the event, and there was already art taking place. For example, there were spontaneous memorials. People were coming out. They were leaving things at the site. And that in itself, I think, is an outpouring of some kind of creative response to the disaster. So.
But do you have a mainstream response, like a movie from Hollywood? Is there not some, again, morals here, making a few bob of the death of 3,000 people? Liam?
You can look at it that way, but it depends what you're calling an artistic response. I mean, there's been a whole range of artistic responses photographically, through the visual arts broadly. Some of them have been very controversial. I mean, a number of artistic works, for example, focused on the falling bodies from the buildings. Now, they became very controversial because a number of them were asked to be, well, they were basically removed from their exhibition spaces in New York shortly after the event. It was too raw, and people didn't want to think about that, and they certainly didn't want to see it. On the other hand, there have been, art projects that have taken a kind of longer breath and that might stand the test of time. I'm thinking particularly of the biggest photography project, and that was carried out by a photographer called Joel Meyerowitz, the only photographer in the world who was given complete access to Ground Zero during the so-called recovery period. No other photographer had access. Now, he used it to create an archive of 10,000 images and has just begun to publish some of that and beginning to exhibit it across America. It's going to be held by the Smithsonian Institution, and it's quite clear that it's going to become the most important image archive of the event of 9/11 and what it means for America, and that people will study it in years to come. Quite what it means right now is open to question, because clearly it's done in such a respectful fashion. It doesn't really pose any questions about the politics of what happened. What it really does is memorialize this as a traumatic event for Americans. And I completely understand that, and it is an important photographic project. But I think that that's what we'll be looking back on in the future, is to see what kind of projects like that, artistic, cinematic, media-led, will survive time. And right now, that's one of the biggest markers, that one project.
But that's a photographic exhibition.
That's photographic, yeah.
But what about what's in it and what's left out?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, the images we're going to see, is who controls them? Is it the photographer? Is it the...
Think more broadly about the photography around 9/11, in fact, it really was quite amazing, because we have, as already been mentioned, the advent of forms of digital photography, which means we now have a lot of so-called amateurs, you know, the people on the street with camera phones were taking images of 9/11. And so it wasn't just, as it were, owned by the professional media. And more that is the case. Acts of terrorism, acts of spectacular urban violence are now being filmed by people who are present with all kinds of, you know, digital phones or whatever it should be. The attack in London was probably the most significant example of this. The most famous images that come out of that attack were taken by people utilizing camera phones, etc. And so there's a new kind of media that's beginning to deliver to us a new kind of imagery of urban violence at this point.
And this image of urban violence is an anarchic one. It's one created by ordinary people. There's no function to it. There's no organization behind it.
Well, you know, let me just say first that 9/11, of course, challenged art at the highest level and challenged architects to come up with a memorial response to this that was, you know, that matched the, you know, the pathos, the depth of the tragedy, you know, the immensity of it. And it's been an utter disaster, a second disaster. The official projects, the competition for rebuilding the World Trade Centers, produced some of the most overwrought, pharaonic, and meaningless designs, universally rejected by the families of the victims and most New Yorkers. So on one hand, while you have these new subcultures of art, and you have a lot of unofficial commemoration and difficult dialogues about the meaning of all this on the highest level of official public art, of monumental architecture, the United States is in something of the crisis. There's no Vietnam Wall. There's no memorial that's actually matched to the experience.
They also collected designs for the Oklahoma City bombing, the monument to that event, and they actually asked anybody who wanted to send in a design, and they had a very interesting negotiation when they finally came up with the final design for that, because a lot of people were sending in things that the developers thought was kitsch, but they had to sort out the meaning of that attack through looking through those kinds of designs and sorting out the one that would be most representative, that would be most appropriate for collective memory.
And did they eventually decide on a monument for
Oklahoma? Yes, they did, and it's built, and you can go there. So.
And have you seen it? Does it work?
I haven't seen it, only in photographs, but...
I think that artwork, which has sought to memorialize, has received respectful attention. I think that the artworks that have sought to question have had a harder time of it in America, and I think you can see why. I mean, Americans don't really want to open up a series of questions about what happened. They do want to remember it in as positive a way as possible. I think one of the most traumatic aspects of what happened to 9/11 for the American populace is that really there were so few bodies available to really focus on and memorialize because of the nature of the form of destruction. It was very different from the Oklahoma bombing in that respect. So the question is, what are you actually monumentalizing or memorializing here? Your very few dead bodies are actually available in that way. And I think that what happened is that the buildings themselves, which you repeatedly see falling in those images, in some ways they became what stood in for that pain, that damage to the body. And so there was a real sense that we had to fixate on those and remember them very fondly and romanticize them to some degree. And I totally understand that. But, you know, that does go in the face of how those buildings were looked at by New Yorkers prior to their destruction. You know, they have been mythologized since in a very particular way.
Did New Yorkers not like them before that?
Well, I wouldn't want to generalize too strongly, but, you know, there wasn't the same romance, put it that way. No, they were not seen as very fondly as iconic buildings. There were many other buildings in New York, and even still, that were looked at much more passionately and much more fondly by New Yorkers.
Mike, commemoration, it's a difficult thing to get right.
Well, I mean, you have to remember that American history is all about the repression of victims of massacres. There is no national monument or museum, for instance, to the Atlantic slave trade or to the tens and hundreds of thousands of African Americans that have died. There's no national monument to the genocide of Native Americans. We have a very guilty history here. And, I mean, a proper commemoration of 9/11 has to also be a recognition that there's a whole history that leads up to 9/11, which is no excuse or apology for the people who committed this, you know, this hideous crime. But it needs to be understood in its larger context of, you know, bombed neighborhoods and devastated countries and the chaos that American powers left behind the Middle East and Southeast Asia.
It's interesting how monuments become part of the political landscape. For example, there is a monument to the Holocaust in Washington.
Yes, there's a monument to the Holocaust, but there is no monument.
Or a museum to the Holocaust.
A museum into the Holocaust. To the Holocaust. In fact, there are, our local museums. But collective memory is, of course, the most contested train. But you have to ask yourself, why in a country that held so many millions of its people as slaves and treated them so inhumanly, is there no place where you can take your young daughter or son and show them that history and teach them the meaning of it? It's more than an act of commemoration. It's an essential part of the learning, the education that each generation, you know, should undergo. We have to understand that history. It has an urgency to us. And yet there's no commemoration. I mean, American history is full of open wounds. Maybe most nations' histories are, but I think more dramatically so in the case of the United States.
But monuments can be a focus for political action too. Monuments get blown up by the next crowd, and monuments get knocked down by the next regime. Putting up a monument is an invitation for somebody to attack it then sometimes.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, certainly many attacks throughout history have been focused on some kind of monument, some kind of visible symbol of power. And it seems to attract that kind of energy because that can get that kind of media attention.
We had we had lots of monuments here in Ireland, Liam, that were attacked on different fronts. We had a notorious case here where you had the statue of Gough in Phoenix Park was attacked several times by the IRA. This was an equestrian statue and it was a fine stallion, but the only thing they achieved really was turning the stallion into a mare, I believe. It wasn't very dramatic what they achieved. It was well made. Well, we have a history of that. Nelson Spiller.
We have a history of it, and you could say, in fact, it's generated a quite a rich, I think, artistic tradition in a certain way. I mean, I would point personally to the murals on the walls of Belfast houses as amongst, you know, a great cultural tradition. I hate to see these things disappear. Thankfully, some people are recording them because they record really popular memory as it's lived in the everyday. You know, the people will look at these and they understand this as part of their community, a story not been told through film, but actually really through the community roots. Unfortunately, what happens, of course, in Northern Ireland, because I grew up with it, is that you've got two memories, you know, one's Protestant and one's Catholic, and they go to war. So there's no collective memory in the way that we've been talking about there. And we're afraid the sectarian divide goes right through the psychology of memory there, too.
But, of course, I mean, monuments are often one side's denial of the other side's truth or history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a quite legitimate case in history for pulling down monuments like that of Napoleon and the Place Vendôme during the Paris Commune. And if I'd had my way, I would tear down most of the monuments to Confederate generals that grace every courtyard square in every town in the American, you know, South. It's hard to find a neutral ground for national memory as long as these wounds are open and people are still contending over the past, fighting over the past, keeping it alive.
Well, the case of the Nelson Pillar is particularly interesting because some of my work has been involved in the study of cinema in Ireland, especially documentary. And if you look at the first films made here in 1897 by the Lumières, who of course didn't know anything about Irish history or politics, they were simply reproducing the postcard views of the previous century. You get an image of Sackville Street shot from just below Daniel O'Connell's statue. His head is missing, but perfectly in view is the Nelson Pillar. And what's not there is the GPO. 10 years on, suddenly the camera moves across the street and the GPO is in focus because it has assumed historical significance. Move another 50 years on, the pillar's gone. So, you know, in terms of how you envision just that one street, there are some interesting questions raised by the cinema itself as a medium.
But it was, so Anne, you was going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say that I've never heard of anyone blowing up a monument that had names on it. You know, we heard in that piece the reading of names. Mm-hmm. And names are so important to monumentals, to monuments, I think, and to our memorialization of the dead. After a disaster, when rescuers come to a site and they pull out the victims, the first thing they may ask is, what is your name? And that's the way of restoring social meaning. Mm-hmm. And so I think I remember right after 911, actually, on CNN, there was a list of the names going by to memorialize the dead. And as far as I know, there's never been any targeting of that kind of monument that has a list of names, like the Vietnam Memorial, for example.
As opposed to a single name. That's
right.
Now, the most moving memorial, the contemporary memorial I know, I live on the Mexican border in San Diego, and just on the other side, on the border wall itself, on the Mexican side, people have erected a memorial just in the form of wooden crosses to several thousand people, all of them named, all the names recovered, who've been forced by this wall to cross the border in, you know, the furnace hot deserts or over the mountains, who've died crossing the border. And it's just, it's a grassroots memorial to these otherwise, you know, forgotten people. And it's one of the most moving things I've ever seen.
Looking back, though, after 5 years on from, and terrorism has become a feature of life in America. Fear has become a commonly used word. The war and the enemy within have become a common. Has that affected the whole image creation industry in America? Are we getting a different version of what terrorism now? Are we getting a different version of what the enemy is now? Are we afraid, like some movies, are we afraid to show them now?
No, it started well before 9/11. It started in 1990 with the collapse of communism. Initially, there was a foray into portraying the villain in most Hollywood blockbusters as drug barons in South America, and that still goes on. But the other search was for another enemy, and the Arab extremist became a feature of Hollywood films as early as, what, 1994 was True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Then by the time you get into the later 1990s, the film I talked about at the conference yesterday, The Siege, made by Edward Zwick, is now seen as a prescient film in that it dealt with the operations of Arabic terrorist cells within New York, specifically Brooklyn. But what I found very interesting about that film was ultimately the real enemy turned out to be the American hard right. And you have to remember that the other thing that had happened in the meantime, of course, was Timothy McVeigh. And so the film was actually projecting a step even beyond 9/11 to the response. And that's actually what happens in that film. In the last third, Bruce Willis, of all people, plays this two-star American general who imposes martial law. Well, it's imposed by the president, but on Brooklyn. He introduces control. Soldiers and troops are on the streets of Brooklyn. And as the film points out, one of the ironies of this is that it knits the community together against this sort of force of totalitarian law. And the final movement of the film is with FBI agent Denzel Washington trying to kind of convince Willis that he needs to give up the fight and return control to the people, which he ultimately does, which is too happy an ending. But nonetheless, that film, because of the issues that it raised, seemed to kind of, after 9/11, make people go, wow, I mean, what else did Hollywood do? The other thing Hollywood did was a film called Executive Decision, made in 1996, in which terrorists hijack a plane and try to run it into Washington, D.C. And subsequent to 9/11, a group called the 9/11 Group was established, where military intelligence invited Hollywood producers and screenwriters and directors to say, well, what else have you guys kind of got in mind? Lateral thinking. Now, it's not as mechanistic as them having no ideas of their own, but they wanted to get completely left-field ideas as they saw it. And this group threw up a lot of ideas, apparently. I don't know what they were.
So they're getting Hollywood screenwriters to identify a terrorist threat for them.
Yeah, well, to identify what means of attack might be used, like the hijacking of a plane. I mean, it's astonishing. There was a documentary made in 2002 about it, and the military liaison who works with Hollywood was asked by the BBC documentarian, what did you think when, having seen Executive Decision and collaborated on it, you saw the same thing happen in 9/11? He says, well, I thought it was a tragic coincidence. And the kind of interviewer says, well, did you not see any more of a connection between that? Did you not see that this was an important question about means of delivering thing? He goes, no, it was a tragic coincidence. I don't see how
a
that could be.
Tragic coincidence, a very tragic event entirely. My thanks to my guests tonight, Liam Kennedy, Mike Davis, Anne Larrabee, Harvey O'Brien. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RT Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branach, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.